Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guest.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode 133. I'm Paul Spain, and with me is...
Bill Bennett.
And Steve Sims.
Well, welcome along, guys. Great to have you both here. Now, this is an unusual one because usually we're all together in the room when we're recording this, but on this occasion we're all in completely different locations. Now, Bill, maybe for the benefit of those who don't know you, maybe you can just share a little bit about where you fit into the technology world.
Well, I'm a freelance journalist. I write for mainly non-technical readers in things like Management Magazine and New Zealand Business, occasionally things like the Herald. And I have my own website too. That's really where I sit in.
And Steve?
Well, yeah, first time caller, long time listener. I've been in the tech game now about 20 years, the last 10 of which I've been in Wi-Fi. Pretty much this is the biggest Wi-Fi company that I've started, called Tommy Zone. We're a global Wi-Fi provider in about 108 countries, so all being run out of here in Auckland, New Zealand.
Excellent. Well, it's a privilege to have you on the podcast, and we're certainly looking forward to hearing your comments on a range of topics. But let's jump in and start with a little bit of a discussion around some of the things that are going on in the world of Wi-Fi. Now, there's been a few announcements recently that have hit the media, but of course Tommy Zone's sort of a fair bit closer to what's going on than I guess what is often reported in the media. The particular things we've been hearing about are the ability, I guess, for a mobile carrier to be able to pass people from 3G and 4G standard mobile connections across to a Wi-Fi network and back again. Can you fill in that picture a little bit for people in terms of what's happening and how long that's been going on for?
Yeah, look, this has been a problem for some time, particularly for 3G operators around the world, because you can't just go and build another cell site because they're eye-watering, very, very expensive. Same with 4G cell sites, and you can't change physics. So mobile network operators have been struggling with the problem of how to cope with this demand of data, basically smashing their networks, wanting access to the internet, talking to their network every couple of seconds, uploading the latest photo or tweeting the latest tweet. And you've got to congratulate Mr. Jobs for introducing the iPhone to really slap it to AT&T in the States, where they had to go and spend $35 billion to upgrade their network just to cope with an iPhone. So the Wireless Broadband Alliance, the Wi-Fi Alliance, and believe it or not, the GSMA, the kind of industry body for mobile network operators around the world, they've been collaborating quite closely, particularly in the last couple of years. And the next generation hotspot project, which is what this is all about, is where Wi-Fi hotspots will be a catch-all for mobile network operators that want to unload their data, if you like, and try and make it seamless for their users. So, at the end of the day, the customer doesn't care how they're getting on the internet. They just want the net, but they want it pretty fast. And when they're out and about, they want it hopefully faster than what they get at home or as good. And so clearly with the congestion on the networks, that's always been a problem. So now Wi-Fi network operators and Wi-Fi vendors are being put up on stage as the guys to help save the mobile network carriers. And so
companies like Tommy Zone are the knights in shining armor to help with this picture.
We'd like to think so, because the software that we have kind of helps them with that. And ironically, the Next Generation Hotspot project was, in fact, started when I hosted the Wireless Broadband Alliance here in Auckland back in 2010. And that was when they got involved in the project and says, hey, this is a big problem. Let's get out there and help these mobile network operators make some money out of their customers so they can keep their customers, because it's an ecosystem that is quite viable. When you can bundle these Wi-Fi services with your data services and your 4G services, and all of this stuff starts to become apparent, that stand back from the technologies. No one cares about the technology. All they care about is the user experience on their gadget that they have.
And what they pay for it, I suppose, as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that we've been seeing, and which we knew many years ago as a Wi-Fi network operator, is that Free is racing onto the shores like a tsunami to take out any data network operator who wants to charge for services. And so we are seeing free Wi-Fi services taking over. We are seeing bigger bundles being put together. But, you know, free services are only good when they're given to you in a quality fashion, that they actually work. And I mean, I know one fast food place at the moment is struggling with even just providing a basic level of service. And it's the thing that we see all around the world, is that people provide free Wi-Fi, it ends up being rubbish. Whereas if you see mobile network operators collaborating with some of the Wi-Fi operators, the quality of service is actually quite high.
Right. So now, I guess, you know, in the past there hasn't been sort of a seamless way for you to get access to this, you know, Wi-Fi from your, you know, from your network provider, such as your Telecom or your Vodafone, or anyone really, other than going in and connecting to a, you know, to a Wi-Fi hotspot and, you know, entering credentials in, or, you know, jumping through some hoops. But
yeah,
where this is going, what you're talking about is I guess, a really seamless transition. Where you're in a particular area, they've got, you know, both Wi-Fi as well as 3G or 4G capability, and you know, as long as your Wi-Fi is on, you would be able to you know, automatically pick up that Wi-Fi capability. Is that pretty much what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it is, because right now your gadget, when you take it home, it goes off the 3G or 4G network and it goes to your Wi-Fi hotspot that you have at home, because it knows who you are. Public Wi-Fi networks don't. They're very clunky. They're always fairly hard to kind of log in. In fact, I think the most seamless one that we're getting close to with providers such as Skype Wi-Fi and Boingo, where they're and iPass, who are providing really seamless clients. And a lot of the mobile network operators are using this as a stopgap measure until they kind of find the way that next generation hotspots is going to start heading. But it's got to be as simple as you walking into a zone, and your gadget knows who you are, what you're supposed to be there for, and the network knows who you are and what you're supposed to be there for, and delivers you a great service. So it's got to be the same as when you're wandering through your house.
Great. Well, yeah, we certainly look forward to that happening. Now, a couple of things, I guess, relevant to New Zealand, and we were talking about this before we started, is you know, Telecom, who are putting you know, Wi-Fi hotspots into a lot of the, I guess, the old school sort of phone booths around the country, and offering that to, you know, to their customers, so you can see that sort of you know, Wi-Fi capability moving to be sort of seamless in the future. And one thing that I got a chance to look at a week or two back was a run through of some of the future technologies that Vodafone are looking to roll out. And one of those pieces of technology were their small cells or pico cells, which are the smaller cell sites that can accommodate you know, 1 to 200 mobile connections. But what they also quietly mentioned was that those same boxes can deliver Wi-Fi as well, and you know, that would then, you know, I guess, augment that 3G, 4G capability that they're looking to put into malls and, you know, buildings and small towns and so on. So you can imagine certainly both of those two being able to jump on board with this in the not too distant future. Is that your pick, Steve?
Yeah, we're seeing it now, and I know that the carriers are listening to this podcast. I think the first thing that they've got to look at is site licenses, because there are a lot of landowners right now doing their own thing, and they're starting to talk quite openly about how they want to lock up their own airwaves. Now, you take a very large mall operator, and they have a whole lot of rogue Wi-Fi access points, but if they want to provide carrier-class Wi-Fi and resell that to the telcos, then they've got to get some kind of site license to make that happen. That's one of the keys to the success in this area. Forget what the vendors are saying. Forget about the backhaul options. The bottom line is that if you don't have the zone, don't even bother thinking about it. And so that's rule number one.
So would it be fair to say that Tommy Zone's already hooked up these sort of site licenses?
Oh, we have quite a few in our footprint strategy, yeah.
Excellent. Bill, did you have anything that you wanted to drop in on this conversation? I know in the past we've talked a lot about that, I guess the speeds that 4G is able to deliver, lining very much up with ultra-fast broadband-type speeds. I guess in this discussion, Steve started off with the, comment that, well, you can't change, science, and there isn't, there's only so much bandwidth to go around. Do you think this Wi-Fi is going to sort of solve and maybe allow the carriers to bring a sort of in between offering in terms of the data packages, which are now pretty small for mobile users?
Yeah, I think it's part of the mix. I think that the packages just aren't anything like enough. And even with the plan I'm on, I've paid the extra $20 a month for a bolt-on, I think it's 1 gigabyte extra, and that's still like 5 or 6 gigabytes short of what you really need. I think this is actually quite crucial, and I think that it's going to happen. I mean, Steve will probably know better than I on this, but I think it's going to happen really quickly. I think we're probably looking at this all being in place, by this Christmas. Would that be right, Christine?
Yeah, you've got this already rolling out now with the telecom hotspots, yeah, with Ruckus, the vendor. They've got their footprint already. And, of course, we're going to start seeing this now. They've got to do something about their own carrier strategy to make sure that they keep providing a good level of service to their customers so they can keep their customers. Because it will just take the other guy to say, hey, we've got a faster network and it's in more places. And so it's a gigantic contest. It's kind of like an arms race.
Well, the thing that surprised me, I mean, I used this service in the summer when I was – some of the telephone kiosks in holiday hotspots had Wi-Fi enabled over the summer. And I found, even in the middle of the Marlborough Sounds, I found one. What surprised me was – They didn't ask me to prove that I was a telecom customer to get onto the network, and I thought that was, pretty much a given. But it was open to everyone.
Yeah, but this is where we're starting to see a whole lot of these other strategies come in with advertising overlays. So they now know who you are, Bill.
Yeah. Well,
watched everything you did and grabbed all your passwords as well, Bill. So maybe they're siphoning your bank account as we speak.
Well, I'd rather pay a little, and it doesn't have to be a lot, and not have that, but that's me.
Yeah.
And that's what Boingo's doing at the moment with global plans that, I think they sell them for something like about $30 a month, and it gives you the security and the knowledge that you're using a secure connection to the internet over Wi-Fi, because it does set up all kinds of cool things like VPNs and all of that. Now, when it becomes completely seamless and a next generation hotspot, that's when it becomes a completely compelling proposition.
Yeah. I think there's a few stages to this. For instance, T-Mobile in the US have rolled out an offering there, which I think they've launched in conjunction with their new Nokia Lumia 521 over there. I was reading where they've got you can actually do your phone calls over the via the Wi-Fi as well, but still being a T-Mobile call, you're not doing it over Skype or some other service. But at the moment, that doesn't hand over seamlessly when you move from Wi-Fi into, a 3G or 4G area. But all of those things ultimately are going to, come together, so you just won't think about it, which is, it sounds really good.
I was talking to an engineer about that not so long ago, and perhaps Steve will know more about this than me, but I've got the impression from talking to the engineering guy that doing that handover is relatively simple. Doing it well is relatively difficult.
Yeah, I agree, Bill. I mean, the difficulty that you've got is that your gadget will have a device address somewhere on a network somewhere, and when you hand off to another network, it will be given a different postal code, if you like, and right. They've got to somehow keep all of the envelopes going between each other or the packets. That's how they need to do it really well. And what we're seeing, particularly with, and I use Skype a fair bit between the two networks of 3G and Wi-Fi, I'd be holding a call, go out of a Wi-Fi zone and smack bang onto a 3G network. For some reason, that particular service holds that call perfectly well. So I think it's the apps themselves that are starting to be the clever part as opposed to the networks being the clever part.
Yep, I would certainly agree. That's that seems to be the way it's going. Now, quite a few other topics to get to chat through. So, next one now today was there was a launch event for BlackBerry, the BlackBerry 10 operating system, and the first of their devices for New Zealand. Now, with me being out of town, I've missed this one, but we've been reading up a lot on this. And Bill, you were there in person to have a play around with the BlackBerry Z10. In fact, you've got one there in your hot little hand at the moment. And you also had a little bit of a look at the Q10, which is their new smartphone with a keyboard on it, which of course is very much what BlackBerry was always loved for, was a great device with a great keyboard. Give us your rundown on the event today and what your thoughts were on the hardware and the software, Bill.
Well, it was actually quite impressive, and I have to say I went along with fairly low expectations, because here's a company that's been on the ropes for a while. The product is really good. It's in the same sort of ballpark as the top smartphones around today, the Samsung, the Lumia. I think pretty much the three of these are now just a tad out in front of the iPhone in terms of the hardware, but that obviously will change later this year. Well, we're assuming it will. There's a nice feel to the products. There's also I should point out, by the way, that we're now onto BlackBerry 10.1, which shows you how fast things are moving.
Well, and also shows that New Zealand's been left a little bit behind, because we didn't get this quite as quick as some parts of the world.
the phone was originally announced last May, so it's actually a year since BlackBerry talked about the phone. It was launched in Australia, I think, in March. I think it was launched elsewhere in the world even earlier than that. So we are a little bit behind the ball, but there's actually a BlackBerry New Zealand now. There are staff here, and there seems to be quite a commitment. They've done deals with Vodafone and Telecom, and the approach to the market is quite interesting. BlackBerry is clearly aiming at that sort of corporate enterprise space where it always was big, but they're emphasising the fun aspects of their phone. And I actually asked the managing director of Australia and New Zealand, a chap called Matthew Ball, about that, and I said, well, I guess that having that fun stuff is the price you have to pay for people to not reject your phones when they have a BYOD policy, and when they have a choice of what device they have. They pretty much agreed that BlackBerry has to have Angry Birds and what have you just to be in the market anymore. But there's still quite a distinctive business feel to things. And one of the things that you can do is you can split your phone's identity so that there's a kind of business identity and a personal identity on the same device. And that's roped off, if you like. The two areas are roped off at the kernel level. So you can't copy data from the business aspect of the phone over to, say, Facebook, for example, which will keep a lot of CIOs and so on very happy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's always been one of the strong points for BlackBerry, is it's been secure enough that governments and corporates have been very, very comfortable about having those devices in their environments. It's great that they haven't lost all of their edge in that space, because effectively we're dealing with a whole new operating system, although it was it's also used in BlackBerry's tablets when they launched
The operating system is quite distinct from the others. I mean, it's funny because obviously smartphone touchscreen operating systems can't be that different from each other because the physical form is similar. So there are similarities, but there's a definite different feel to the BlackBerry, and it's nice and smooth. The software and the hardware are beautifully integrated, rather like the iPhone, rather like the Windows phone, and in contrast to the Android, where the two sort of still are a bit clunky. I mean, even with all the fancy overlays and so on, I just don't think Android has that slickness of experience. The other
By saying that, I'm going to get all sorts of complaints again. I got a few last time you slated Android, so just go a little bit easy on Android.
Yeah, I'm not slating Android, but I think that it has a separate set of advantages with its openness and so on. Sure. But the price you pay for that is that it's just not as smooth or as beautiful an experience. And one of the ways which the BlackBerry impresses, I haven't had much chance to give this a real test, so I have to tell you about the demonstration I watched, is that the various apps work seamlessly together. So if you want to take something, I mean, putting that, what I mentioned about the business and personal divide aside, if you want to move data or stuff between apps, it's much easier. You don't have to close an app and open another one and so on. They actually they seem to be operating simultaneously, and the linkages between them are much smoother. I'm going to be giving that a bit of a test. The other thing that was really impressive in the demonstration is that they had one of those big screens, big flat screens, which you often see and you think, oh yeah, more PowerPoint. And they did do a PowerPoint-like presentation, but it was all done off the phone. So there's a cable which just connects to the phone into the back of the large screen TV, and it's good enough. I mean, it would be good enough for you to rock up to, you know, some expo or conference or whatever, and just connect your BlackBerry up and do your presentation. You don't have to take a laptop or a tablet. I thought that was quite impressive.
It's good to see that BlackBerry have caught up with AirPlay from Apple.
Yeah. Well, that's with a wire. Yeah, I mean, I guess we're starting to see that across mobile. More and more of the mobile platforms can offer that type of functionality. I think it's getting to the point where that's just expected. In fact, it was just announced in the last day or two that Windows 8.1, they've got additional sort of wireless, wireless display capabilities that hadn't been in Windows before. So it's almost becoming sort of ubiquitous, isn't it?
This is a norm now, because I also see it around our household where, all of the gadgets are being thrown up onto the big screen and things. So that's a norm. But I just wanted to make a comment also, Bill, is that I think that BlackBerry balance is in fact the killer for any other device that doesn't have a work personality versus home personality. So I reckon you'll see some of these more serious mobile OS people really take the lead from BlackBerry on that, because that BlackBerry balance is really, really awesome.
Mm. Yeah. I get the impression that this is, I mean, the company is still very much going after the enterprise market. And I think it sounds to me very much like the kind of enterprise, the phone that enterprise managers would like to see their staff choose in a BYOD program.
I think the other players will start coming out with it, but I suspect that the open source Android won't.
Yeah. I think that's probably where Android is at its weakest, actually. Mm.
Now, in other devices we've sort of had hands-on with recently, one that came through is some Sony's Nex 6, which I don't know if either of you have been watching the camera area, but we've got a number of vendors there that are delivering cameras that sort of sit between the point and shoot digital cameras and then the full blown digital SLR, and the Nex 6 is Sony's latest in that in those regards. And what it is a smaller camera, but it does allow full interchange of lenses. So there's a whole range of lenses available for it, and it's a 16 megapixel very, very nice results for this sort of smaller size camera, and great video. You know, very fast to shoot. And built-in Wi-Fi, so you can link it up to your smartphone or your computer to sort of see what's on it. I was pretty impressed with this one actually. But yeah, it's certainly a step up from the price point of the lower pointed shoots. Have either of you had a look at these cameras or some of the Micro Four Thirds cameras, which are in a similar market?
Yeah, I've seen some. I think one of the interesting things about what Sony's done here, and this actually impresses me, that they've gone for 16 megapixels. They haven't gone for some ridiculously high number of megapixels, which they can't deliver good pictures and so on. They've actually resisted the temptation to go for 30, 40, 50 megapixels, which is what you're seeing in some other cameras. And that sounds like they know what they're doing. They really know what they're doing.
One of the other impressive things is the detachable lens market, because there is a stockpile of detachable optical lenses, and you can see the kind of quality of the backplane that they've got there. But if you've got yourself three or four lenses that you love, they're going to fit on these, and so you don't have to go out there and buy a whole new lens set. Yeah. So that's a major investment for a lot of people that they've made over the years. I mean, I have, and so this is going to be a really handy way to kind of bring out the dead lenses again and stick them on these things.
Yeah, we're starting to see those those converters become available, so you can bring a mix of lenses across. Now these they're calling it E-mount, which is it's a relatively new lens standard, but it's being used across a range of Sony devices, including some of the video cameras, and with those sort of third party converters, being able to plug in lenses and so on onto different devices, it's quite fascinating. And the idea of having Wi-Fi and even 3G starting to be built into cameras also opens up possibilities for taking that content and quickly moving it around, which is great.
Yeah, I think if I was still in publishing, if I was still working for a publisher as opposed to being a freelancer, I'd probably spend some of the budget on buying one of these.
Yeah, and they've got the next 7 is actually a variant with a 24 megapixel sensor, so they are going up into those sort of higher megapixels as well. But only for those that really really need it. It's it's not something that's across right across the range. But
it's for astronomers and astronauts.
Exactly. So well worth a look anyway. If you're looking at cameras, and you get really a lot of the benefits of the digital SLR, but without the weight and the lenses generally a little bit smaller, not necessarily, and by being purely doing away with the digital SLR technology, there are some some things you lose, such as an optical viewfinder, but there's also a number of number of benefits there in terms of the way they cater to that. Couple of other bits and pieces which we'll probably dive into more next week, because we haven't got time for a huge amount of discussion. We've had a look at HP's new Envy 15. Now they've been releasing the Envy sort of 15 range for a few years now, but we've had a little bit of a play around with the newest one, and some details of this are still not public, so we're still waiting for the sign off on giving those details out. So I think we'll probably come back on that one over the next episode or so. The other gadget I've been having a look at that's also due to be launched shortly is the Fitbit Flex. Now, we're starting to see a whole range of, I guess, you know, wearable technology type devices, and this is, I think, the third device from the team at Fitbit who seem to sort of be leading the race in terms of gadgetry to, you know, help you track your exercise regime. Have either of you had a look at this? Steve, have you been keeping a bit of a watch on the wearable technology space? I think you know, you've got at least one gadget in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I do love my Pebble watch, and I wish it was as cool as this Fitbit, because anyone that knows me, including my beloved family, would know that I'm trying my hardest to lose a little bit of weight. So having something that actually tells you that you are or not, in terms of how many footsteps and things, gives you an incentive to kind of wear it.
Yeah, I think it's a good encouragement, isn't it, if you can track those things and see you're getting a little bit higher up in the graph, right?
Yeah, well, that's the point, because us human beings need that positive reinforcement of graphs and pictures and people telling us or things telling us that we're doing the right thing. And this fits the bill. It's $100. It doesn't drain that much of your battery when you're using it. And really, it's a nice way to, if you really want to expose it to your friends, show everyone else how you're going.
You can tweet them and so on, right? Yeah, I think it's $100. I think it's launching here about 100 and... 180, the New Zealand variant, which is not far off at all.
Well, I can see application already in other places, like, for instance, orienteering, which my son does. You know, wear one of those, see how many kilometres he's run, how many, you know, even altitude. I think that's not on this one, but, you know, those kind of things are starting to become very, very commonplace.
I can see someone in my family buy me one of these as a present.
Well, I think
I'm going to have to buy my own somehow.
I think it's nice. It's, I mean, it fits the bill that it's something technical, so they know that I like it, and it's a caring thing to buy someone, so that's good too.
Yeah, well, I think what we're going to see over the next couple of years, and at CES there were you know, loads of them, but we're going to see a real onslaught of wearable devices that are going to be you know, focused on fitness, on health in general, and over time these things are going to measure a whole lot more details. So you can imagine in the future that, you know, your doctor will get in touch with you and say, look, we've noticed that this is happening with your heart rate or your blood pressure or XYZ, because actually all those things will be monitored and will be fed back, you know, in a way that you agree with into you know, certain sort of systems. And, you know, in the same way, I guess we've seen, the management of technology move in the last few years to be managed much more proactively rather than, you know, the old break-fix IT support. You know, we should expect the same, you know, with our health. And by using these sorts of tools and a health system that you know, hopefully becomes more and more progressive, you know, we should end up being a little bit more ahead of health issues.
So a question to ponder there, Paul and Bill: which country is going to be first in the world to implant these at birth?
Oh,
I don't know. It might be. Well, I guess if you if you implant them. Yeah, would that work? That sort of need to grow.
Oh, you'd have an additional graph called temperature.
Well, last week we were talking about. I think it was last week. It might have actually been in the week. One of the stories that came through from the US was a. What was it? There was a pill that you swallow.
Is this a password recovery thing?
That basically verifies you are who you say you are to authenticate with a particular piece of software, etc. Rather than having to remember all sorts of passwords, you drop the pill and it looks at your acids inside you and says, oh yeah, that's Bill or that's Paul or that's Steve, and passes that back to Google or Microsoft or whoever.
Spooky.
It's a scary world, but yeah, all sorts of fun and crazy things coming up. Now, Computex is, I think it's currently on at the moment in Taipei, and this seems to swing around reasonably quickly, but it happens this sort of time every year. There's always lots of announcements of new gadgets. Also happening at the moment, Microsoft have got their TechEd conference on in the US. Now, there's been a few announcements and bits of information that have been coming through based on these two events. Now, one that wasn't unexpected is the next generation of Intel's core processors. So we're talking the Core i3, i5, and i7 that we find in devices, you know, such as the MacBooks and most standard PCs. Of course, Microsoft Surface Pro has the core chips from Intel in them. But this next generation, the Haswell chips and associated microarchitecture is due to launch, I think over late next week actually. Wednesday next week, but if you're interested in that, there is a bunch of info that has been hitting from Computex on that. Lots of new devices shown off, and the other one from Intel, which is also getting attention, and we've talked about before, are the new Atom processors that are they're calling Cedar Trail, which also bring a bunch of advances, and we'll see lots of devices starting to come through on as well. I think that's a little bit later on in the year. Now, in terms of devices that we've seen announced in the last few days, one that particularly jumped out is this new Windows tablet from Acer. Now, this seems to follow in the footsteps of what we've seen from Google with Android running on a lot of smaller tablets, and then late last year, of course, Apple with the iPad Mini. Now, Steve, you're a pretty big fan of the iPad Mini and that form factor. What's your pick on Windows moving into the smaller form factor? How important is this for Microsoft?
It's massively important, and can only be kind of matched as long as they've got the price point there and they've got the features that can kind of match the desirable devices that people want for that size. And the thing is that form factor is big enough yet small enough to be useful. When you're sitting there reading it on the couch, it's not heavy and clunky, and it's not big and massive with a big glow on your face, but also it fits in your jacket pocket. So that form factor is brilliant. Now, if you can put a good processor in it, a decent amount of memory in it, and some really cool apps and a nice display, it's going to work really well. So, the Windows 8-inch tablet should work particularly well, particularly with higher screen resolutions coming down the track.
Yeah, the one thing that jumped out on this one was, You don't normally see a keyboard paired with a smaller size tablet, but with the Icona W3 from Acer, that's actually one of the options. And the reason it in particular jumped out at me is I was talking to a business owner last week who said to me, look, can I tie my smartphone to a keyboard so that I can I can get bits and pieces done without having to carry a big laptop or a huge device around. And it's interesting seeing some of the comments online from people saying, oh, this looks ridiculous with a keyboard and that's madness. But Bill, do you think there's an interest in having a smaller tablet like this and having the option to pair it with a keyboard?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was looking at it thinking, well, once again, remembering that I'm a journalist, this would be an ideal tool for me. I mean, I use my, if I go away to a conference or go away to cover something big, I don't take a laptop anymore. I take the iPad, the 10-inch iPad, and a keyboard. And that's good. I mean, that works for me, and for the next year or so, that's going to be how I do things. But when I come to refresh, I was actually looking at the picture of the 8-inch thing. I was thinking, I wonder, the fact that you can stick it in a coat pocket for you know, when you don't need a keyboard. That's great. I don't know. I think this has a lot of potential. I'll tell you what, I bet this sells.
Well, it seems like this was shown off by Microsoft at the TechEd event, and you know, it's got, you know, what you were talking about earlier with the BlackBerry. It's got a micro HDMI port, so you can jack that you know, straight into a monitor if you want to as well. So you know, we're starting to get down to these small devices that can replace your PC, but you walk up to a monitor and you can link into it, and you know, of course, with the refresh of Windows 8, the Windows Blue or 8.1 variant, you know, having more of those wireless display type capabilities, that's got to help as well. But when I saw the picture, it actually took me back about 15 years to when I used to use a Palm Pilot, and I was traveling various parts of the world, Russia and Asia and India and so on, and I traveled around with this little Palm Pilot, little modem that would attach to get me online for doing emails, and in my suitcase I would carry a little fold up keyboard, and when I wanted to get in touch and do my communications, I would take this tiny little Palm Pilot with a screen smaller than most of the smartphones we have today, attach it to the keyboard and tap out my emails. So there's sort of a harking back to technology of old when I still have
one of those in my technology museum at home.
Oh, fantastic. I wish I knew where my old Palm Pilots were. I went through a few generations of that technology.
Mine's gone. I get rid of that stuff. But it's interesting that you were saying that, because I remember a device around about that same time, probably a bit further ago, maybe 20 years ago, which is a very small HP device which had built-in Lotus 1-2-3. And it had a mono screen, but it was about the size, it was roughly that size. And it was small enough to put in your pocket. And I remember this guru-type figure from HP was brought out to New Zealand to demonstrate the thing. And he put it in his pocket and he said, one day all accountants will have these.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, jumping back to the Computex type bits and pieces and all those various announcements and the things that that Intel have been shown off. Now, we had heard that these new processors from Intel were maybe going to double battery life, but we're now seeing real figures. And just one of the slides that The Verge have shared online shows a whole range of numbers, and it doesn't look as though a doubling in battery life is realistic. Certainly not in this first round of the chips. They're showing an example where on the old last generation of chips, you'd get 6 hours worth of battery life doing HD video playback, and with the same size battery, that will jump to 9.1 hours. But there's a next generation sort of starting to there are the more mobile friendly chips that will start to come out later on during the year. So we'll be certainly looking forward to getting a bit more of a hands on and a closer look at that. And next week, actually, Intel are doing the launch for this region out of Sydney. So I'm expecting to be there, and we'll see what more we can find out as we have a look at more of those devices.
I was talking to someone from one of the hardware manufacturers not so long ago, and he said that this year they expect to have products which can go for almost 20 hours. So
that's the that's going to be the devices that are based on the new Atom chip, and
all right.
Which has got the Cedar Trail as its sort of code name, and what's happening with the Atom, because that's compatible with the core chips from a software perspective, so you can run all your existing Windows apps. I mean, certainly Apple could be using that as well for Mac OS X, but what they're doing with this generation is they're dramatically improving the performance. There's a talk of, you know, potentially double the performance and battery life that could triple. So a lot of the, you know, the thinner and lighter tablets that we see today running the full version of Windows run an Atom chip. And, in theory, those could stay a similar size and yet move to a 24-hour battery life. Now, I'm not sure that anyone wants... I'm sure people would like a laptop or a tablet with 24-hour battery life, but I think there'll be more interest initially in slimming down the devices and saying, well, look, give me 8 to 12 hours, but give me a tablet that's even thinner and even lighter. That would be my thought. What's your thought on that, Steve?
Well, it's more so about battery life these days, and with all of the battery technology that's being biffed out of all sorts of labs all over the world, it's encouraging to see that the chips are getting more efficient with electricity, because once these new batteries come out, you're going to end up with tablets that'll last for weeks, pretty much like a Kindle. So that's what I'm really impressed about and looking forward to.
Now, just jumping to Windows 8.1, because there's been a huge amount of information released in the last week around this update. Now, it seems that Microsoft are addressing a lot of the complaints, particularly from people that didn't like the change that Windows 8 sort of brought in terms of a user experience. So Microsoft have brought back have confirmed they're bringing back the start button into Windows 8.1, but there's also lots and lots of sort of little tweaks and adjustment that just make the experience much nicer. One of the things that was minor, but I think will help with this, what some people have called quite a jarring experience, moving from the sort of the modern UI back to the Windows 7 type screen on the desktop, is that they're now no longer locking you down to what sort of screen background you can have in that modern or metro UI. So you can have the same desktop background actually across both, which, although it's a very small thing to do, I think just makes those two worlds feel a little bit closer together. One of the other things they've got is the ability for you to set up Skype. So if your machine is actually locked and someone is trying to call you on your tablet or your laptop, you don't sort of have to log right into the whole thing first. Now, I'm sure there'll be some security things around this, and not everyone will want to allow that, but having that sort of straight bypass to be able to answer calls sounds like a good thing. Bill, have you looked at some of this material on Windows 8.1? Because I know you've written and blogged a fair bit around Windows 8 and your experiences with jumping into it and then jumping back to Windows 7 and then realizing that I guess Windows 7 has some shortcomings compared to Windows 8. What's your take on this?
You have to get in and test those things to be sure. And like I said, I went back and realized that going back is not really an option. I think the thing is first of all, let's give Microsoft some credit for getting it right. There were question marks over that at the time of the launch. They're certainly heading in the right direction. My feeling is that the 8.1 is actually going to be quite a big upgrade, a big change, which is interesting because they've also committed that there won't be a charge for people to go from 8 to 8.1. So I think you're seeing some a level of response to the market. I mean, despite what companies like Microsoft say about giving people what they want and demand and need and so on, that's not usually the case. But I think that the fact that they are responding so much to what the market is telling them is very interesting.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that it's a little bit of catch-up here that these guys are doing as well, because in the new world of software platforms, where everything is starting to get a bit more app-driven as opposed to just the OS, they're kind of making it a bit more intuitive, so you can use fingers, gestures, all of those kind of things, rather than the good old clunky file, open, close, save as, all of that stuff. So I think this major upgrade is great. I mean, one of the catch-up points I must mention is search on 8.1. Search is magic on other platforms, but it's great that that's a catch-up feature that that Microsoft have acknowledged.
Yeah, it looks like they've sort of got that right. It was something that certainly surprised me with Windows 8 when it came out. There wasn't sort of a unified search function. You had to give the operating system some direction in terms of what are you searching here? When you type in a search, is that for the web? Is it for this or that? And of course, if you're inside an app, that was very, very obvious. Now it's sort of got a unified search function that'll be looking across all the various areas, whether it's web search or music and movies and apps and so on. So it's certainly looking forward to having a play with that side of it.
Well, I got quite cross with Windows earlier this week when you know how if you go to the Metro search, you find something, you think, oh yeah, that could be it. And you click on it, and it's not it. And you have to go back and do the whole damn thing all over again.
Oh, okay.
And that is just appalling. In other words, on the Metro search, it doesn't save what you had. It does when you do the search from the desktop. You go into the Explorer and search. You can. So if you're searching, say you're searching for stories that you've written that use the term SkyDrive, and there might be 100 of them on my machine, you've got to know which one. You can't preview it and say, oh yeah, that's the right one. You find it, you search, you find it, you look at it, and you realize that's not the right one, and you have to go back and do the whole search from first step all over again. It's incredibly annoying on a desktop,
right?
And that's the kind of thing which actually gives Windows 8 that kind of unfinished feel.
Right. So do you know if that's one that's been addressed in this? Or it seems like the change will probably address those sorts of things, but we're still waiting. I think it's the 26th of June in the US anyway that this update will become available for those that sort of want to try a test version of it or beta release that they're making available in preview form. Following that, we'll certainly share our experiences as sort of the hands-on. A couple of the other things that I noticed is they're building SkyDrive right into the core of the OS, and that will help with especially with Windows RT machines like the Surface RT and some of the RT devices from other vendors, because those devices didn't really allow great cloud integration with SkyDrive because of the fact that you couldn't you can't install traditional Windows apps. So having that built in, I think will be really, really helpful. There's a new version of Internet Explorer coming. They're going to release Internet Explorer 11, and then there's a bunch of new apps and bits and pieces that'll be bundled. But worth going online. There's some really good write-ups around this release on sites like Engadget and The Verge. There's some good commentary from Mary Jo Foley on allaboutmicrosoft.com. So if this is of interest, definitely worth diving in. We certainly can't cover it all in one podcast. And the other thing worth mentioning is this is really the start in a way of seeing Microsoft transition really the rest of their business across to much more regular software updates. So we've seen that with their their cloud offerings and some of the consumer products, but with Windows 8.1, we're seeing a new version of Windows just a year after the previous version, and Microsoft are doing the same thing across a lot of their a lot of parts of their business. So we expect to see a new version most likely of a lot of the server products from Microsoft, and that's something I think businesses and enterprise users will be watching really closely, because they're used to having to wait a really long time between releases, and I think this will help keep Microsoft much more competitive, rather than having to wait two or three years for a software update. Often in the past we've seen Microsoft sort of get leapfrogged by all sorts of others, be it Apple with new features into OS X and so on, or some of the more enterprise type players. I think this will be really helpful. How do you feel about that, Steve, being a big Apple fan? Of course we've seen OS X updates every sort of 12 to 18 months. Is this essential for Microsoft to really up the ante with these more regular updates?
Well, again, I come back to the word catch up, and I don't mean the stuff that you put on your chips. It really is a situation where the business model is changing for Microsoft as well. They are thinking more outside the box of how people treat computers as opposed to how computers treat people, and so that shift has now made that the groundswell of change in the way that they're looking at their baseline OS, and it's really coming out with regular updates. I mean, Google do an update every 2 days or whenever, and so the whole point with release cycles is not necessarily to implant new features. It's to keep polishing it and keep sweeping the floor and changing the business model to be nimble enough to cope with the demands of what's happening out there. I mean, when was the last time you bought a piece of shrink-wrapped software? Hasn't happened in the last couple of years, I would suggest. So where is Microsoft going to be making its money in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Actually, if you look at their annual report, it's very interesting where the revenues come from. And the reality is, come from a whole lot of different directions. Still Windows and still Microsoft Office being very, very strong, but a lot of their business products and of course Xbox. So
we're doing a full circle then.
Yeah.
Way back in the '70s, we were doing mainframe computers, and that was the cloud back in the '70s.
That's true.
Doing the same right now, and this is where people are making money in that area. I mean, look at Xero's share price today, $1.6 billion. It's a cloud business. So should Microsoft be. Mm. So should Apple be.
Well,
and
Xbox has been an interesting one, because we've just had the announcement about the new Xbox in the last few days, and we'll hear more at E3 about the gaming side of it, and I'm sure more throughout over the next few months. But that's been a product where for a number of years now Microsoft have been pretty much doing an annual update to push forward their Xbox product, and to a degree reinvented every year or so with varying levels of refreshes, from a fresh user interface to things like the Kinect and so on. So yeah, I think it's pleasing to see them upping the ante and pushing this right out across what appears to be most parts of the business.
Now, I love any software company that goes and tries to kill the time vampire. If you can kill the time vampire, you're going to win lots of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a few other little bits before we finish up. Now, Igloo, who last year, now this is the company that's owned between, 51% by Sky TV in New Zealand and Television New Zealand, they've had a little set-top box in the market for $199. Too rich a price, it seems, for many, and an associated prepay subscription service. They've just dropped the price of that box now to $99, at least for the next month. Any pick, Bill, on whether this is going to help them sell through a few more of these into the market? They don't seem to have picked up a whole lot of customers just yet.
No, I don't think the price is wrong. I think the product was wrong, and I think that's the issue. And dropping the price tells you Well, it speaks volumes about what they think of it. But it's just it's just not enticing at any price. I mean, if they gave the thing away, I still wouldn't want one.
I guess its main shortcoming is that it doesn't let you record TV programs and play them back later, which just about everything else on the market does now, including a number of TVs, right?
Yeah, but the other problem is almost like a sort of social thing, and it's that Igloo is in effect Sky TV for poor people. I mean, I know that that's not necessarily who's going to buy it, but that's how it's going to be seen. And, I don't think people want Sky TV for poor people. I think people want, they might want Sky, a cheaper Sky subscription maybe, but I just don't think the product is right. There's something wrong about the thinking behind it.
It's such a boring product. Wake me up when you got something exciting with it. And it's not TV for poor people. It's just, who remembers TiVo? Yeah. I mean, come on, guys. This is 2013, and they're coming out with a 1992 Nokia phone. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we were going to talk about the Telecom Geek Zone community router collaboration project. We're not going to squeeze in too much discussion around that, although it would be one we'd probably end up spending a bit of time talking about. But there's a chunk of information there on Geek Zone around that, and if you're a real tech head that likes to have a tweaked out router. And you've got an interest in what the next router from Telecom should look like, then jump in there and have a little bit of a look at that one. Now, also the Surface Pro, we talked about that last week, finally launched in New Zealand last Friday, so that's in the market and available now for anyone that's been waiting for that to land locally. $1,349 for the 64 gigabyte model, and $1,499 for the 128 gigabyte one. And also we've had official confirmation of a Samsung Galaxy S4 mini product. Now, we had heard of this one actually ahead of the release of the S4, and we'd also heard some noises about the waterproof and dustproof sort of rugged variation on the S4, which I don't think Samsung have confirmed yet, but the S4 mini is confirmed. Now, Bill, what's your pick on this? Just how mini is the S4 mini? I think it's a 4.3-inch screen, isn't it?
Yeah, which makes it bigger than most iPhones, and I think it's, I think it's Samsung having a bit of a server Apple. Even calling it the mini is a bit of a server Apple. It's not that mini, is it? I mean, it's the specs a bit lower. It's
it's a pretty high end device. I think it gives people the option to get that S4 type functionality without quite the same price point, and not quite as high end in terms of specifications. But there are plenty of people that like a smaller phone. Now, Steve, you're a big iPhone fan. We talked about before about your keenness on Apple products. Are you starting to feel that your iPhone 5 screen is too small with all these bigger screen devices coming out?
Now, this is really important, and you've got to listen carefully. The Samsung Galaxy S4 is starting to turn me, because I was so impressed when I played with one last week. I thought, wow, this is actually almost better than an iPhone 5. And some of the stuff that it was doing, the form factor was great. If anyone from Samsung's listening, please give me one to go and play with for a week so I can actually extol the virtues of how good it was. I was impressed. And so, for once, I've actually gone, I could probably do this. I'm yet to be convinced, but I'm pretty close to...
You're on the line there. That's fascinating.
Well, you know what would really excite me, and I've heard rumours of this, of a plain Android Samsung Galaxy S4, without the software, without the overlays and so on. That sounds really quite exciting.
Well, we've seen that Google are going to be launching there's going to be variants of the Galaxy S4 and the HTC One, both without the sort of the add-on software and extras from HTC or from Samsung. They're just going to have plain Android on them. Now, in some ways, that means those devices are going to lose, you know, a lot, especially the S4, lose their edge because they've got some really special things from a software perspective. But then you certainly get the most up to date version of Android and you get that cleaner device. But I think if we look at the number of devices with Android that are sold with just the raw Android, it's actually a very, very small percentage, and it seems those types of devices don't sell in big numbers. So,
The application is pretty huge if you think about it, with not so many apps on it and all of that fat stuff on it, but if you stick something like Vend on it, it becomes an instant till. Mm. Or a ticketing application, it becomes a thing at the gate. So it's cheap enough and smart enough to go and start being more useful for specific niche applications. So I think that's really cool.
Mm. Okay, now next week coming up is Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. There really are all sorts of events going on at the moment. So there'll no doubt be a bunch of interesting announcements from there. Steve, what's your top pick for announcements next week?
It's being coined iRadio. It's the Spotify killer. It's going to be the subscription service that you do from iTunes, because right now the iTunes radio stuff is rubbish. And soon you'll be able to create your own playlists for free. I reckon you'll get a bit of an advertising thing there. If I was a radio station, I'd kind of be a bit curious as to what's really going on there, because when a global radio station goes online that's yours, like Spotify, etc., and you make it really, really simple, and maybe you pay 99 cents a week to have it, it makes it easy for you to buy the tracks instantly. So kiss goodbye to things like Shazam in the future, because you'll just be able to buy it online straight away from your gadget. So iRadio is my big pick for next week's WWDC.
And do you think Apple are going to change from only making their these sorts of services, or primarily making these sorts of services available to Apple hardware owners, or do you think they're going to take a tip from some of the others and offer this across other platforms?
iTunes is already cross-platform anyway, so that argument's out the window.
Well, I'm talking sort of Android and Android and say Windows Phone, etc. What are the chances they're going to go down that track?
Someone will do a plug-in somewhere and pretend to do something. I mean, there's a challenge for a budding entrepreneur in New Zealand to go and code something like that up.
Fair enough.
Give it a go.
Well, that wraps us up. It's been a bit of a bumper episode this week. We've covered a whole bunch of stuff, fairly in depth in some cases. So thanks everyone for staying with us and for listening into this episode. We will catch you back next week. Now, Steve, where do we catch you online? What's your Twitter handle?
Twitter handle's @Simsy, SIMMSY.
Excellent. And anywhere else where people should look for you?
Oh, you can find me on LinkedIn, of course, and otherwise. To become a Facebook friend, you've actually got to come through my front door at home.
Fair enough. Love it. and Bill, you're pretty easy to track down in the online world, aren't you?
Yeah, Bill Bennett, NZ. BillBennett.com.co.nz. God, I'm stumbling there. and anybody can meet me in the real world if they want to buy me a drink in a bar, I think, but...
Fair enough. And it's pretty easy to track me down as well online. Thanks to tools such as Google. My main blog is techjungle.com, hosted by GeekZone, and I'm on Twitter @PaulSpain. So that's where you can track me down. Of course, nztechpodcast.com is our main home for the podcast, and do track us down on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and even Google Plus, which is starting to get a bit busier these days as well. So thanks everyone for listening in. See you soon. Bye.